Fucking movie.
Yeah, that is a way to put it. I hope you've got some insights, because all my notes are like, this is crazy, this is crazy, this is nuts. This movie, I think, is, I put it in the same category as Godzilla Final Wars, which I don't know if you ever wind up tracking that down, but
I have it. I just haven't watched it yet. I own it, but I just haven't watched it yet.
Okay. Yeah. It's well produced. So it's not kind of like the Psycho Goreman, like total fever dream approach, but it is, it kind of is. It just has this like kitchen sink approach where it makes me think, like, and I apologize to people that like this movie. I don't mean there's no way of saying this that's not going to come off as like some backhanded slight. It makes me feel like a child wrote it. And I say that because it's like, if you gave a kindergartner a chance to direct a Hollywood movie and they're like, okay, the main character is going to be a brain surgeon, rock star, superhero,
scientist,
celebrity,
physicist.
Yeah. And it's just all of these things where it's,
I'm everything. That's what it was, you know, like the character was everything. And at one point I'm like, so is he God? Is that what he is? Probably is at this point. You know?
Yeah.
So crazy. No, I will say this is the most extensive I've ever researched a movie, because as rich and as like crazy and out there and how the movie goes on tangents left and right, so does the production. So, well, really? I found some really interesting stuff behind the scenes. So,
wow.
I kept having to like, well, who the hell is that? Who's that person? Then research them. I'm like, that's crazy. You know? So it just kept going in all these different branches. So it'll be fun to talk about.
So the definitely guy that came up with this was probably Buckaroo Banzai in real life and just striking out in every direction.
Actually, he was, yeah. Well, let's get into it then. So you want to do the intro, or, well, we already are.
Yeah, we're into this 2 minutes deep. You clicked on it. This is the post credits podcast. I'm Brian. That's Matt over there.
Yeah, today we're talking about Buckaroo Banzai, or
Buckaroo Banzai
for short. You know, or the Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai across the eighth dimension.
Bucky Banzai.
Wow. So the director, W.D. Richter, he wrote Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 78. I know that there was one before that, you know, okay. And then Big Trouble in Little China, and then did the screenplay for Needful Things. Those are like the highlights. So kind of around, you know.
I can sort of, now that you say that, I can sort of see the Big Trouble in Little China influence, because that's also very much we're just going to do everything kind of movie.
Right, right. And then the other thing that I was blown away,
they got a lot more restraint, though, in Big Trouble than they do here. Because at least they just kind of stick to like one or two genres. And it's sort of a mashup between like the trucker movie, tough guy, two-fist tough guy thing, and then this like crazy Hong Kong action movie.
So there's like a reason why it seems like everything under the kitchen sink was thrown in. And that was kind of because of an overzealous producer. And I'll get to the larger story, but he was like a micromanager on the movie. His name was, I'm looking it up right now because I have so many notes. David Beagleman. And he just wanted things a certain way. And at one point, there was kind of, well, there was this back and forth, like pushback between him and everyone else making this movie. And he just got so tired of trying to micromanage it that they tested to see if he was still paying attention by talking about this like watermelon. And it's actually in the movie, right?
Okay.
And he didn't notice that they shot that and then put it into a cut of the movie. And so when the whole cast and crew realized that, they're like, oh, he's not paying attention anymore. Now we're going to do what we want to do. And that's when it's like, here's the floodgates of all this shit. You
know? So it was like there's a million ideas and nobody said no to any of them.
That's right.
Is a way to get back at this guy for.
Yeah, for like being like the friction in this set where everyone, like everyone on set. It took convincing to get people on board, but once they were on board, it seemed like they were really enthusiastic about making the movie once they were filming it, you know? So everyone except this producer was like, yeah, let's do it.
Like, you know? Like the actors and whatnot.
Yeah, like Peter Weller was happy to be there. John Lithgow, he was one of the harder ones to get involved, but then like once he got involved, he was basically saying that he wanted to like go like further than he did in the Twilight Zone movie. Like he wanted to go beyond the craziness of that.
I think
that's how we got this character. I think
he did that.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Everyone's acting their ass off. Goldblum, Lithgow, Peter Weller, like, yeah, and they're all great at it. It really must have just been like that perfect storm, like once in a lifetime, like we can just get away with anything. So let's just do it.
Well, the parents really weren't home after a while in the making of this movie. Uh-huh. So yeah, it's exactly it. It was just the perfect storm of like really not having a lot of supervision, having the budget that they needed. And then it's just like, hey, the governor's off because the producer's out of here. Let's just go do it.
Wow.
You know? So
incredible.
Fascinating. So this movie got released on August 15th, 1984. Guess what it went up against? Do you know what it went up against?
August 15th. Man, I mean, I saw that and like, well, there's another classic movie, 1984. Like, you did it again.
Right, right.
I don't know. I can't think of what came out in August. My day
Star Trek pleasant. Part 3, The Search for Spock, which is okay, but you got to know, coming off of Wrath of Khan, people are probably lining up to see that shit, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Okay.
Another heavy hitter. And Ghostbusters. That's what it went up against. Like, fuck!
Hang on, hang on. Those movies just happened to be in the theater or it was opening weekend for all of them.
Ghostbusters was in the theater. It was opening weekend for Star Trek 3 and Indiana Jones.
Okay. Yeah, like, that's...
You're screwed. Because it's like sequel power is a big thing. It's a familiar thing. And then it's like, here's this movie that we can't really describe to anyone, and we're going to shelve it up against these two powerhouses, you mm-hmm. know? So... and it made $600,000, which I think is still good for 1984 money. But
what did it cost to make, though?
Well, total over the course of its theatrical run, it did $6.2 million,
uh-huh.
which is a long shot away from its $17 million budget. So, yeah, mega flop.
Which would be like your $300 million Avengers Endgame budget nowadays. Right. It's because inflation's gone out of control.
Right. And it also flopped so hard that Sherwood Studios went bankrupt. And I tried to find out, like, well, what other stuff did Sherwood Studios do? And it's buried under so much internet because now there's like Christian movie studios that are called Sherwood Studios, and that kind of takes up the algorithm because they're actually in business. Okay. So I don't know what Sherwood Studios was responsible for.
Yeah, and you can't really find it or uncover that. You know, it's possible that it could be the same Sherwood just resurrected because, man, you know, like Ed Wood got into making Christian movies for a minute. And okay. I don't know. It probably isn't. It's just one of those things where it's like low-hanging fruit. Someone just liked the name from Robin Hood and thought it was a good, yeah, let's use that kind of thing.
Right, right. And then Gene Siskel actually predicted the future when this movie came out, and he reviewed it, stating that at some point, this movie will become a cult favorite. So it did. You know, it's always, I always wonder how movies that flop this bad, right, end up resurging or like surging up again, like bubbling up to the surface and becoming like popular. Because as weird as this movie is, and as hard to follow and kind of complex and odd, a lot of people love it. A lot of people know about it, mm-hmm. you know, but for, you know, not making it, not even half of its money back, you would think it would be like something larger, but it was a flop. I mean, it was devastating, you know?
Yeah. It's impossible to know what the video numbers were, what the circulation was, if people kind of like made a tape and then passed it around and it became one of those like playground rumors, like, oh, you haven't seen Buckaroo Banzai? You got to check this out.
Yeah. When is the first time you saw this? When did you first see this movie? Do you remember?
About 4 years ago.
Okay. Well, I saw it as a teenager. I'm curious what you thought of it, because I've got some nostalgia for it that kind of blinds me to like its weirdness, you know?
Yeah. No, it was one of the movies we were playing at 38, and it came in off satellite, and like Buckaroo Banzai, like, God, we'll play anything, you know, like just the name alone I thought was crazy and off-putting. And then it comes on and you're like, Peter Weller's in this? Maybe I'll give it a shot. Christopher Lloyd, Lithgow, Goldblum, like it just keeps going.
Yeah. And what's crazy, I didn't even know this, speaking of like the mind-blowing, how like the people that are in this movie, Jamie Lee Curtis was in this, but her scenes were cut. But she plays Buckaroo Banzai's mother. And they actually shot it. It just didn't make the theatrical release. So there's footage out there somewhere of flashback sequences with her and Peter Weller.
Okay, thank you. Flashback. I'm thinking,
yeah.
Did they age her or something? Like,
no.
Oh, what's her name from Halloween that was Tom Atkins' wife in Halloween 3? And you're just like, yeah. There's no way they're... and you're just like, there's no way they're in the same age bracket. But nah, that's fascinating. I was just in awe of just how weird, weird that this movie was. And I felt like, you know, maybe I should track it down because, you know, this is the syndicated version. There's bits they have to take out for running time so you can pack your 40 minutes of commercials into 2 hours, you know.
Right.
I don't know. Am I missing things? Am I not? It's probably pretty crazy. I should track it down at some point. Never did. And then, yeah, last night was the second time. And I'm still just like, nope, it's crazy.
I don't even know. Like, I want to say it's drugs, but that's like super dismissive. I want to say it was just a big bag of cocaine that was in like the back lot of this movie, you know, and they're like, we're making a movie.
Yeah. You know,
like, but it seems like there's a lot of thought put into it, especially like when Peter Weller was talking about how the space in between matter and how like you could travel through it, which was the theory was kind of proven in like the late 80s, you know. So there was like some intelligent thought behind like some of the themes that they were talking about in
well,
this movie.
You know, someone had an issue of Popular Mechanics and they
sure
wrote it into the script there.
Right. But it is a fascinating movie. So how, like, what's really funny is like I struggle to describe like the plot of this movie. And it is kind of like a They Live, War of the Worlds type of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
On like a surface level.
Well, that's good, because that was one of my questions for you, is like, how would you describe this movie in a tweet?
Yeah, I mean, that's the best way that I could describe it. But like, it's just War of the Worlds and They Live, because, you know, there's direct things that are very similar to They Live with like, you know, certain people. When something happens to them, like in They Live, it's the sunglasses and then they can see the aliens, right?
Uh-huh.
But in like, in Buckaroo Banzai, Jeff Goldblum, weirdly, kind of off camera, soft-spoken explains that there's like a bacteria that they can grow, and it emits a thing that you can then breathe in, and then they, and then whoever breathes that in can stop the mind waves, and then they can see the aliens, because the aliens are like producing these like, not hallucinogens, but like visual blocking aids, so they just look like humans, right?
Is that what happened? Okay.
Yeah, so I found this awesome quote, and this is from John Lithgow, because, you know, people ask him about this movie a lot, right? And I would imagine that anyone who's in this movie gets asked about it a lot, because it's such an oddity, right? And he says, I've tried to explain the storyline to people, and it takes about an hour. I mean it. It's that complicated.
That is great.
Yeah. So, I mean, he is, you know, the main villain, crazy main villain with the nasty teeth that looks like they were dyed by, like, the blackest of wine.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, just he's crazy.
He's got the hair messed up.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, he almost looks like a human-alien hybrid, so, like, he's not... Because they've got the other guys that are running around, or were they the resistance or something? Because he teams up with them at one point.
Right. So I struggled with that too. And I read like a breakdown of this movie. And apparently when he gets put through the wall, like, because, you know, it's like he has the flashback when he puts the electrodes on his ear and tongue and hands, and then suddenly has a flashback to him going through the dimensional wall or whatever.
This is different from the torture scene.
Yeah.
Who has the electrodes on him?
John Lithgow.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So like when he gets transformed into an alien, I just always, like, the first couple of times that I'd seen it, I just assumed he was always an alien. But when he's half through the wall, like, the aliens just look like they're wrestling with him, but they're actually putting one of them inside John Lithgow. So when he comes back out, he's no longer John Lithgow, and that's why everyone thinks he's insane.
Is that the same slug they tried to kill Buckaroo's girlfriend with? They set up this like elaborate death table in the basement, and then it's just a slow slope going down there. And I noticed like her clothes get more ripped off in every scene.
Yeah, did you notice like the amount of like things of torture that they were doing and then not doing? Did you notice that to her, to Penny Pretty, PRDDY? They put honey on her arm, and then we're gonna put fire ants on her at one point. Like the what's his name? The guy from Ghost, Vincent Schiavelli, the instantly recognizable sad face actor, you know?
Yeah, that guy's in everything. He was in Batman Returns. Tomorrow Never Dies is the suicide doctor.
Yeah, yeah. So he's like, they're trying to get information out of Penny, and he's in the background, like, swabbing her arms with honey. And then there's just this close-up of a cassette tape holder with fire ants in it. I was like, so you're just gonna put the fire ants on the honey and then what? You know, there's just so many little things where it's like they don't explain it, and if you're not paying attention, it's just like you just don't think about it. Like,
yeah, no, yeah. And that all seems to happen off camera, because like the whole time they're sitting there like twirling their mustaches like, yeah, we're gonna do this to you and you're gonna break and you're gonna tell us what we want to know. Yeah. And we're gonna do this horrible thing and then you'll never get it out of me, and somehow we cut and then, but yeah, that scene keeps happening over and over again, and then she just keeps being in these more elaborate like devices tied up somehow and getting her clothes right. ripped off and thrown around, and it's like, man, like, that poor actress.
No shit. Speaking of that, like, did you find that...
That's probably what everybody felt like dealing with that, like being held hostage by the producer you're talking about.
Oh my God. I wonder what it was like. Because did you notice the aesthetic shift during this movie, like how the movie looked. No.
No.
There's too much other shit going on to recognize
it. It's too crazy. Like I couldn't even really follow. I mean, it's so interesting that you can follow exactly what's going on and then at the end of it still not be. So what'd you just see? You know?
No, it honestly feels like you're on drugs, but not on drugs at the same time, right?
Kind of,
you're completely coherent about this, but then, yes, it's like, it feels like you're in that post, you know, fog.
Yeah.
Of like a really long experience, you know, where you're like, yeah, I remember what happened last night, but kind of.
And then before you know it, like Goldblum's walking around in a cowboy outfit, and you're just like, why not?
Oh my fucking God.
Sure, why not?
He looks like a fucking stuffed animal, dude. Like a toy.
And he's got the biggest smile on his face. Like, that was probably his idea, too. Like,
I found something really peculiar, though. He has a signature walk, and I didn't realize until the very end of this movie. And because he walks, and he kind of has his elbows out, right? And he, like, shifts a little bit in each stride. Uh-huh. And it's almost like kind of like a tough... You know how, like, people are like, I'm so strong, but, like... You're not, though, but you just have your elbows up and you're walking around, but his is kind of a little different. He walks exactly the same in Independence Day at the end of that movie after they crash back into Earth from, like, their, you know, Hail Mary attempt with the nuclear bomb in space.
So that's his idea of a hero walk?
Either that or that's how he walks, and I'd really... I want proof of that. I want to see if he's just walking. I'm a celebrity. I do normal things. He's in a park or something, but he's just walking like that.
See,
you know?
Yeah, I don't think he is. I think that's probably what he does, because Goldblum's one of those actors. I love him. I'm not trashing him because he's so unique and fun to watch and everything. But he's one of those actors where I never... forget that I'm watching Jeff Goldblum. It's just like, oh, Goldblum's a cop today,
or, yeah,
you know, right. Goldblum's a scientist today, and it,
yeah,
it's never the other way around where I forget who I'm watching is
Jeff Goldblum and everything. But it's okay because he's so unique to watch, you know. It's always Jeff Goldblum, but today I'm the fly, you know.
Right. And he just has such interesting rhythms in the way he puts emphasis in strange places.
That's a very good impression. I'm pretty jealous.
Thanks, Psyche. It's one of my many useless skills that don't apply to the real world in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, so we're going to touch on this crazy producer guy for just a minute, because I mentioned the tonal shift, the aesthetic twist, or shift, through part of this movie. So you get to the start of the movie, and I'm like, the very beginning, you know, you got the rocket car, which is also like a fever cocaine thing into itself, on how they made that, and I want to touch on up on that in a second, because I don't want to get too schizophrenic.
Yeah,
because it's like, that car is like, who, what?
That
it's,
was one of the crazy. Few things that they actually kind of sort of pay off later on, because they bring it back.
Maybe
it was just too far, like I was too far gone in the movie or just not caring anymore. But he drives it back the second time and it's kind of like, you know, that kind of looks like the Tesla truck now.
it does. Okay, so there's this shift in how the movie looks, like how, the depth of field and the colors. And, you know, it happens quickly, and you don't really notice it, because like it goes from like very dark scenes, and I'm talking about like up until like the nightclub song thing where, you know, like
whatever that was.
Yeah. Thrown under the bus because she's crying because she had a bad day.
Yeah.
Right.
It's kind of like that must be where Spider-Man 3 got the inspiration for that. scene.
Right. So the original photography for this movie was done by Jordan Cronenweth. Now, what he is responsible for was Blade Runner. And that's what the director wanted. He wanted that like awesome depth of field, soft colors, which is exactly what you see in like up to like the dance or the musical stuff in the club, right? You see all of that, which is like awesome. I really love that. This producer wanted the movie to look like Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? And without the consent of the director or the cast or anyone involved with the movie, just because he didn't like how the movie looked, which is not his vision, he's just a producer, he fired Jordan and hired the guy that did the director of photography of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So there's this clear shift where it's like, if you really think about it, after that club sequence, it does look like Raiders of the Lost Ark. If you're thinking about it, like the colors are very similar. And then, you know, before that, it does look like a different movie.
I can't say I noticed that. I guess I'm a little more obtuse with that, with some of these 80s films, because they were kind of in a great era before people started doing their entire production design through color grading. Because nowadays, like, they do make choices on set where wardrobe is doing this because we're going to emphasize these colors in the background. But nowadays, everything just has this color blasted look to it where it's just, you know, if done poorly, it looks like a bad Instagram filter.
Right.
And they just didn't do that back then, where it's like, we're just going to do this through lighting and what they're wearing and whatnot. And it just, it looks so much more natural to me that I just tend to lose myself in that and just feel like it was, no, that's just life, because that's what life looks like. It's just sort of, I mean, larger, you know, larger than what a camera can get perspective. That
I think you'd be able to tell more if you looked at like the depth of field between like the first part of the movie, like the first 20 minutes and the rest of it. If you compared them, you're like, yeah, that is kind of different. It's like different lenses or whatever are causing that, you know, but it's, you know, up to it was the change of the director of photography that caused that.
I wonder if it's a wideness issue as well, because lenses can really do that. Things start translating in a different way, where a lens, just because of the way that it captures light, has kind of a circular shape on the front. And the more wide angle the lenses get, the more straight lines have kind of a flex to them.
Yeah, yep.
So like your fisheye, it's just bow-legged. A straight line would be bow-legged. But then you bring that back to like 28 millimeter, which Spielberg likes, Scorsese likes. 35 is considered the standard. I like 28 personally, and then I just happened to find out that that was one of the favorite lenses of Spielberg, Scorsese, and Kubrick.
Okay.
And it like, I am
good company.
I'm doing something right.
Yeah.
Because to me, it just looks more like reality, like the way that our eyes see.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So maybe that's part of that as well. And if I'll have to keep that in mind if I ever watch it again, and
okay,
have enough brain juice left over, you know, because you're the gears are turning so hard trying to follow the plot of the movie.
Oh yeah,
get to pay attention to the cinematography as well.
Oh, of course.
Maybe I should just put it on and turn the sound off and just watch it.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's just. There's like so many little things that it's like, that's so odd. Why are they doing that? Like when for example, did you even know that there's even two different sets of Lectroids? Those are the names of the aliens, by the way. There's two different kinds in the movie. There's the red and the black Lectroids.
Okay.
And see, then I assumed
that
they were all the same.
I saw that there was a difference, but I just thought like, oh, they're making these masks different because they're trying to introduce some kind of variety, or, you know, kind of do the Star Trek thing where it's like color blindness, but with aliens.
Right.
You know, because there's different races of people, so there'd be different races of aliens. So I But no, I'm giving them too much credit for that.
No. The other interesting thing that I saw is to tell the difference between them is that the black ones, the good ones, they all are have feathers around their necks or around their heads. And then the red ones, the evil ones, don't.
Okay.
Just so you know.
All right.
Just a subtle little detail in an already extravagant movie. I didn't realize that, and I had to, that was in a breakdown of the movie as well. I didn't realize it either. So
let's steer this back to the car, because you were going somewhere with that.
The car off is a little bit. Another I can't like the what went into building the car just seems like another like cocaine filled fever dream, right? Because it's like how it's one of those things where it's like you wonder, how did no one die? You know, how did no one get hurt just being in the cockpit of this thing, right? Because you would have just assumed that it's a prop on wheels, right? And that's it. It can drive and that. So it started off as a Ford F-350 truck, right? Which, that's a huge car. Like, the 350s are, like, one of the largest trucks that, like, Ford makes, has always made.
Yeah, my dad had a 150 growing up, and I thought that thing was a tank.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not, obviously not the same size, but the impression whenever I see a 350 is, like, that's borderline semi-truck. You know, like, it's not, but... and then, okay, so the whole chassis has been reinforced, the frame, with, like, roll cages and stuff to withstand, like, forces of gravity. And it's like, well, why? It's just it's a prop car, right? Well, the front end is a Grand National stock car, right? The scoops on it to keep it from lifting off on the back, right?
Spoilers.
To keep the air pressure down. Spoilers, yeah. That's from a fucking DC-3. It's a fucking World War II plane, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, this makes sense from a design standpoint only because the first time we see it in the story... He built this thing and they're doing some test on an airfield of the speed of it. It's just that, like, it's so not aerodynamic that there's no way it could go that fast. But you're probably going to tell me that, like, no, it actually had, like, a jet engine in there.
It has a purpose, right? All this is leading up to something.
Okay.
So the cockpit is modeled after a fighter plane cockpit. So, like, very sturdy. So why do you need all of these things? It's a prop car, right? It's because it's got a fucking jet engine by GE in the back of it. A real fucking jet engine.
Nailed it.
On loan from Northrop University.
On loan, so they had to give that back. Wow.
Yeah, but in the movie, you can actually see the jet engine. When you see the back of the car, there's these two pipes that come off the side, and then there's like a giant... tumbler looking fucking hole, right? From Batman, you know, like that thing where the flames come out.
Yeah.
No, that's the real jet engine. That's not just what looks like a jet engine to make it, you know, look cool and we're going to shoot some flames. No, that's honest to God, real jet engine that they have in there to propel the car forward. Like, what the fuck?
See, this is what Pattinson should be driving in the Batman. Because it sounds like somebody actually designed the Batmobile. Like,
it does, right? Like, yeah. It seems like everything that they put into this car didn't really seem like it was for the movie to make the thing look cool. It was like purposeful. And they're like, well, the only reason how we could have a jet engine in it is to reinforce the chassis,
yeah,
and then put, you know, spoilers on it to make sure the car doesn't lift off and hydroplane over dirt.
Yeah, and we have to build it on an F-350, so it's so heavy that it can't lift off as he's driving it.
Yeah. That's so crazy.
They did that with another movie. Something kind of similar. Aliens. With the APCs.
Yep.
They use like the heaviest thing on the planet, like the heaviest vehicles, because they were basically runway service vehicles.
Uh-huh.
And they're just like all lead so that the planes can't blow them over when they're moving.
Yeah, and they were for big planes, not like little tiny ones, like 400 seater planes, you know, like intercontinental planes. And what's really cool about the APC though is it's all just trick photography, because obviously the interior is a different set that's not actually inside, because the only inside that they had was like a 2-foot by 4-foot space, and that's where the door slid open. So it was always done with multiple takes of people exiting the thing, mm-hmm. because they could only fit like 2 or 3 of the actors into that space.
Yeah, and then just pull a clown car with it.
Real quick, another really interesting thing about the APC is they didn't realize how heavy it was, and they didn't reinforce the set. The set was strong, but they didn't realize like it needed to be so much stronger. So the first time it rolled onto set, it started buckling the grates, like where Sigourney Weaver had to drive it, you know, she wasn't driving, but like where I'm just saying, like where she had to go on the set.
Yeah.
You know, so they're like, back it up.
Right.
back it up. We're about to destroy everything. So yeah, I was going to fall.
And they just like destroy everything because no one can hear on the inside. Right.
So crazy. The APC, I will say like, if anyone gets the Alien Quadrilogy like on Blu-ray, it's got those like mammoth documentaries for each movie. They're so fascinating. The lengths that they go to, especially when they start talking like special effects, is really fucking jaw-dropping for Aliens. You're just like, holy shit. You know, what are you doing?
That's why it's so good, you know. Mm-hmm. Movies like that, it's money's great, but passion is how things actually get done, and people that are just super detail oriented like that just have, like James Cameron, just have endless amounts of passion. So it's not a mistake why his movies usually turn out to be really good. It's because he just puts certifiably psychopathically insane amounts of energy into making them.
Not to keep going on Aliens, but then even like the people making like the paintings, like the mock-ups of what the place is going to be, like all the little details they put into it, like eventually made it into the movie. And the thing I keep going to is like Bug Stompers, like that was just an inside joke, but then, you know, that logo got painted onto the side of the dropship, you know, so it's like, oh no, everything that you drew, we're going to put into the movie. Okay. So it's really cool.
Speaking of painted art, during the big hero walk at the end of the movie, which just conceptually I find really interesting, because it's just kind of a collection of the gang coming together, and, you know, it has a real cool rhythm to it, but I'm not like watching that. I was actually really in awe at the level of staging and planning that must have gone into that, because it wasn't random. Like, he, you know, start walking out and then this guy comes on and then that guy comes on, and you all have to figure out what location to do this at and everything. And that was really cool. But the graffiti where they walk by, like right at the end, and it says Buckaroo Banzai. I don't know if you noticed it.
Yeah.
It clearly had been sandblasted off the wall a couple of times and then redone, because whoever was doing it must not have figured out the proportions quite right, and then they're setting up the shot and it's like, nah, it doesn't look right, we got to do it again, and whatnot.
So. Yeah, I noticed the sandblasting, but I didn't know if it was like they sandblasted it just to do the logo or just like the text treatment, or it's like they had to, like what you said, they had to do it multiple times for the framing, you know.
Yeah. Or Buckaroo Banzai has so many adventures, this happens after every time the city's like, fucking Banzai, just gotta clean it off, and then next week he's just right back there.
You know, I want to be famous like Banzai, you know, because he, at one point in this movie, he steals a Harley, right? And the guy who's like the fucking he's just like the delivery person for the motorcycles, I don't know where these motorcycles came from or why they're like shuffling them into this building. But he's so in awe that Banzai is there that he doesn't even give a shit that Banzai just stole a Harley from him. I want to be so famous where people are just happy to see me if I steal something from them.
You know? I don't know. I think it'd be annoying. That a little bit of anonymity is actually a really nice thing, especially, you know, in the age of like social media where everybody's kind of like F-list internet famous, but at the same time,
oh yeah,
you know.
Yeah, F-list internet famous.
It'd be interesting though, like back in that time, just to think of like how famous he must have been. Everybody to be talking about him all the time, this awareness in an era where there wasn't social media, like people weren't getting this from their Twitter feed. It's like,
I mean, like Michael Jordan famous, because even if you didn't like sports at all, you still knew who Michael Jordan was, you know.
And I think it's beyond Michael Jordan famous, it's like you're the entire NBA famous.
Like, right, also like you just trust, you have so much trust in him. Usually when someone's super famous, there's like, yeah, but there's got to be that one thing, right, that they're like a super creep about, right?
There's always contrarians, especially nowadays, where we gotta take everyone down a peg for no reason,
right? But he's doing brain surgeries, he's saving the world, he's also a rock star with the Hong Kong Cavaliers.
There was one point where one of the generals says, I don't know, he's been through like a teleporter or something. His brain might be scrambled. And then someone instantly shoots him down. And we're like, well, he's never been wrong before.
Prove you wrong. Did you notice how like his hair is always wet? Buckaroo Banzai's hair is always wet throughout this whole thing, this movie. Like, it's kind of crazy because at some point I'm just like, it's got to dry off at some point. It's either he's always hot or that's like something that he's putting in his hair. But then I wondered if that's what people in the 80s looked like with that like greasy fucking hair. I wonder if there was someone on set, right, that like they had one job and they were paid hourly for this, right? And their whole job was just to be on standby with like a bottle of water,
a can of sprayer, right? Dapper Dan.
Yeah. And hair then tonic. It's like, yeah, he's just by the camera, slightly off, and then like the director yells like, hey, we need more wet. And then he just comes out and like sprays Peter Weller's hair. So it's just constantly in a state of wetness throughout the whole movie. I just felt that was odd. And I think like the only person that can pull it off where I don't give a shit about was Kurt Russell. Because I think his hair is mostly wet in all of his movies. But I just have never cared to mention it before. Maybe it was Kurt Russell that influenced Peter Weller.
That could have been an intentional choice, just done in a weird way, because you see in a lot of like Michael Bay movies, the street's always wet. Mick G does the same thing. It's because they hose the streets down because it just looks better for a feature film. You get all these specular highlights everywhere. So you always have that perpetual look of it just rained. So maybe someone's like, hey, we're going to do that, but with his head. Okay, hey, whatever. We're making Buckaroo Banzai, man. Like,
right. We've got a dump truck of cocaine.
Yeah.
And we're making a movie.
You want to have his hair perpetually wet so it always picks up highlights? Done. It's in the movie. We're doing it. Next.
Yeah. I have another interesting detail that I saw on the second viewing. The recent second viewing. You ready?
So you watched it more than twice, or this was the second time you saw this?
No, I watched it more than twice just for this episode, but I've seen it about like 5 or 6 times total.
Oh, wow. You know? See, this is why you're so far ahead of me on this.
The aliens drink battery currents from lantern batteries. You know, those like big square rectangle batteries. You know what I'm talking about? From the 80s that weighed like 10 pounds. Like the 6 volts, the 6 volt batteries.
Mm-hmm.
They have them screwed together. They're in a car. I don't know which one it was, but Christopher Lloyd's driving and they're talking back and forth about Buckaroo. And he's in the middle of what looks like he's drinking out of a cup, right? As one does when they're riding shotgun in a road trip, right? So I didn't, like the first couple times I didn't realize it, but this time I realized that's a fucking battery with wires like wrapped around each other, and he's just sucking on the wires. He's just drinking battery current.
You mean we're going to have aliens drink acid right out of batteries, giving them like high powered electrical current? It's done. It's in the movie. We're doing it. Next.
I know. It's just all those things. Like, what the hell's happening? I also did one thing I didn't understand, which was never explained to me, is like, why does Buckaroo shock everything he touches after he got shocked? You know, like everything he touches, like he can't come into human contact with anyone. You know, he shocks the doctor.
Shocks Penny back to life.
Yeah, yeah.
After he's been in contact with a lot of other things.
Yeah.
You would think at some point he would have, yeah, become discharged or grounded. You mean we're going to give Buckaroo electrical powers 90 minutes into a 95-minute movie, and he's just going to shock everyone and goes around touching? It's done. It's in the movie. We're doing it. Next.
Right. So what do you think about, like, the connection to War of the Worlds? And it, because, like, War of the Worlds was that, like, radio broadcast that freaked the fuck out of people so long ago, right? But in this movie, they're saying, like, oh, that was real, and that's how some of these aliens got here back then. Some of these red lectoid troids. That's such a hard word to say.
It's that was supposed to be from War of the Worlds?
Yeah, that, like, the aliens arriving actually happened, and then H.G. Wells or whoever did the broadcast, and then he was brainwashed by the same aliens to retract that statement so they could be, like, doing their own thing, you know,
behind
the enemy. This is another very quick Jeff Goldblum-ism during this that's explained, and it's a blink and you miss it. You grab your cell phone while you're watching it, and he's in the middle of this speech, you'll miss it, you know, but he's talking about that. And specifically, he says, like, because, like, John Warfrin, he is the played by John Lithgow, calls collect John Big Butte, and tells the operator that he's calling from Grover's Mill. Grover's Mill was a real life community in New Jersey where Orson Welles' famous radio broadcast War of the Worlds happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they tried to be like, yeah, that's not a hoax, that actually happened. But Jeff Goldblum said it in about 15 seconds.
You know, what's interesting about that broadcast is it's become kind of, you know, this infamous thing, this urban legend. And there is this sense that there was this mass panic that happened. And there really wasn't. It was, okay. It was a couple of people freaked out. But it was one of the first times where people realized, like, no, you actually have to be responsible with broadcasting and what you say, unlike today where they just don't give a shit and they'll just lie constantly, because it's, well, that's their business model. It's just
right
whipping people right into outrage over, makes me so goddamn angry.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of cool. I really like that story, and there's been, unfortunately, like, the movies called War of the Worlds have not been as good as, like, the story, but there's been other ones that have been fantastic, you know.
You like the book for that?
I do like the book. It is hard to read because it's just from a different era, you know. Yeah.
It's a little dated, and yeah, you know, like, it takes place in the 1800s. People are riding around on horseback and things like that, and
right, yeah.
We've become so acclimated to think of, like, oh, they're landing in the city, and the city looks like just like what we see when we look out the window, but it was like farm country. And
yeah, and like almost like a swamp is where this orb landed, you know, in the book. But like the whole idea of, like, a War of the Worlds story is always, like, fascinating to me, because if you bring it to reality, like, how would that pan out? Like, obviously, if they're landing on Earth, they're a much more advanced civilization. So, you know, logic would be like, well, their weaponry is probably much more advanced than we would have. So it's an interesting, like, how do you combat that? And it's more of, like, a story about, like, the human spirit over, like, oh, we got to fight these big bad aliens, right. You know?
Yeah.
And I think, like, Battlefield Los Angeles does that really well, you know, and, like, to a certain extent, like, Independence Day does that really well. So, but then, like, the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds is like, It's Dakota Fanning screaming for 50 minutes. So,
yeah, haven't seen that one.
I was excited for that one, but
I know you were, and I remember you were really disappointed.
Oh, yeah, not as disappointed as some other things I've seen, but that's neither here nor there. But
Spielberg was on kind of a losing streak, in my opinion, at that point. Because after Private Ryan, he had a couple of movies, both of which starring Tom Cruise, who I usually like in a lot of these things, but Minority Report I thought was garbage. And then,
I liked that movie when it came out, but I watched it like a few months ago. I'm like, ugh. it's pretty bad. Yeah, it doesn't hold up at all.
And then I think War of the Worlds was their next movie, and it's like, I'm just not watching that.
yeah.
That's how I win.
I want to go back to like the beginning of the movie though for a minute. Like, if you're at a dance club, man, right? You're having a bad day, and then you get called out for having a bad day. Do you think you'd like assault the person on stage that called you out for having a bad day? Because it's like, man, you're already having a bad day. And then like some pretentious singer gets on stage and they're like, someone out there crying? Someone out there not having a good time? I'm going to put this fucking spotlight on you and we're going to talk it out. Like, I don't know. I just feel like that's a good way to get honky-tonked, you know?
Honky-tonked?
That's when you take a guitar and smash it over the head of somebody.
Okay. All right. I'm learning so much during this episode. Whenever I'm having a bad day and I'm angry, the last thing I want is for someone to ask me what's wrong, because I'm going to blow up at them.
Right. And we're not talking about like, oh, you know, something like trivial happened that kind of was an inconvenience. No, like real bad day. Mm-hmm. Not a good day. Sky's falling type of bad day.
Yeah. I'm a Hulk just wants to be left alone kind of person when I'm really angry.
Right. Yeah.
I'll figure it out. Just leave me alone. Give me some space. Otherwise, you're going to get your head bit off.
And then to top it all off, to make you feel better, the person would sing you a song on a piano. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I just feel like it's that whole kitchen sink approach of like, let's make him the most amazing human being with every superpower on the planet, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of worse than the original Superman, where he could fly, he was invincible, he had strength, he could stop time originally,
yeah,
for God's sakes. And then at some point you're like, you know what, Superman's a little OP, we gotta patch this out here, so we're gonna do some revisionist history. He can still shoot lasers, breathe ice, be super strong, invincible, good looking, have a hot girlfriend, but the time travel. No, we got to stop that. That's right. Crossing the line. That's what nobody did here.
No. Yeah. Everyone just, I feel like it's one of those things where, and we've talked about it before, where it's like, hey, this is my first movie. I'm just going to do everything I can because it'll probably be my last, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was the mentality for the writers and director of this. And then the producer was like, well, we got to pull this back and we're going to do it my way. And they just kept doing their thing and he basically gave up, you know?
Well, that sounds like what happened there is like, once you open the door to that, you had all these like really talented people who are extremely disciplined. They're just like, this is Candyland. We're never going to get this chance again to just go with it. Like, just
why not?
Yeah.
So let's talk about this producer, because it's kind of crazy. Like, so his name's David, once again, I don't know if it's Beagleman or Beagleman, but American film producer, and responsible for a lot of big name talents in like the 60s and 70s. But what was really interesting is in 1977, actor Cliff Robertson received his 1099 tax form from the IRS. But on it, it said that he had received $10,000 for Columbia Pictures, which, now, just to let everyone know, this movie now is an MGM movie, but it was a Columbia movie at one point, right?
When it was released originally, and then they folded into MGM.
Yeah. You know, and then like rights management got passed along. Who knows how that works, you know, like, because it's so complicated.
Now Amazon owns it because they bought MGM.
Yeah, no shit. So it ended up, and so he talked to the IRS, and he was like, I don't know what this $10,000 is. This actor, Cliff Robertson, was saying that, right?
Oh, yeah. Because they're like, where's the taxes on this?
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, I don't know what that's from. But, you know, the IRS are like, stop lying to us, right? So an investigation gets opened into this. And it resulted into an investigation into Columbia, like the whole movie production company. And then they found that Beagleman embezzled more than $65,000 by doing this to the actors under his, because he would have package deals like they used to do, like a lot, and kind of what Netflix does now, where it's like you have kind of a group of actors that you work with constantly, and then you sell them for like three or four picture deals, or this group of actors together for three or four picture deals to companies, right? Mm-hmm. But he would embezzle money through these actors by filling out these false tax reports. So he did this for like $65,000, which is not a lot now, but like in 1977, that's pretty significant.
That's still more than most people make in a year.
Yeah. But he ended up, first he was suspended as a producer for Columbia and then reinstated, only to then get fired because the head of Columbia liked Beagleman, but then he wouldn't fire Beagleman. So then everyone under Columbia said, okay, we're firing you. And then they got a new head of Columbia, a new CEO. Okay. And that CEO was like, hey, Beagleman, you're fucking fired.
There's get out the door, of here. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kirk Douglas, who actually worked under him, and Kirk Douglas, Michael Douglas's father, who worked for Beagleman at one point, wrote in his autobiography that, or his experience with this. And he was like, you know, this town, or Cliff Robertson, the actor, exposed this like embezzlement scandal. And then he gets the door, and then Beagleman gets like a standing ovation. And he ended it with, who do I have to fuck to get out of this business?
Wow.
You know? So that's the producer of this movie.
That's I'm the guy we're dealing this. With this whole time.
Yeah, I'm only telling this because like this guy's crazy, you know. And then during this investigation, they also found like peripheral stuff about Beagleman that wasn't true. Like he was a liar. He was a con artist, basically. And he stated that he went to Yale and was on like the Who's Who directory. And do you know what that is? Like a who's who of a college?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, like the people that like are aces at what they do. Like they really excelled, you know. Mm-hmm. He never went to Yale. Never graduated from, of course. Why would he?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that's like, why would you lie about this when it's like, even back then, it's easily verifiable that.
Yeah, yeah. And especially Yale, that's an Ivy League school, right? What, there's only like 10 of them, you know, in the United States. I mean, I don't know why I had to like say United States. So leading up to the Buckaroo Banzai, he was just a constant micromanager. And at one point, he threatened to shut down the whole production because he hated the red-rimmed glasses that Peter Weller wore in two scenes in this movie. He was going to shut down the whole fucking movie just because of these fucking red glasses. That's crazy to me.
I'm seeing a lot of parallels with Phil Spector.
Who's Phil Spector?
Oh, that's a fun thing for you to look up. Phil Spector was a music producer and real control freak. He invented some really cool things like the wall of sound, where one, you sing the part one time, then you sing it again three times and you stack it. And it's like one person just sounds like this really powerful choir. They do that with instruments and things like that. But he also was crazy and abusive and a drug addict, held several people hostage at gunpoint, including the Ramones, were like, I'm going to blow your head off if you don't record this take the way that we want. And they did it some ungodly amount of times. He wound up going to jail because he did finally wind up shooting someone, because there's only so much cocaine and booze you can do constantly while you're waving guns around and somebody just doesn't die eventually. Right. And then, yeah, he got wind up sent to jail, and everyone was in show business was basically like, thank God that nightmare is over. Of course, nobody came to his defense. And it was one of these things like, oh, I'm going to petition Trump to pardon me. And of course, it never happened. You know, so he's just rotting in jail where he should have been he probably should have been in a mental institution for as unstable as he was. But yeah, real crazy, like true Hollywood stuff there. So yeah, Phil Spector, man, guy's nuts.
Yeah. So then leading into the marketing for the end of this, they didn't know what to do with this movie. They had no idea. I mean, like, but how do you?
We don't
like,
even I don't know. Think that. We couldn't even talk about it, let alone make a 30-second commercial. Like, we barely made an hour episode, and I still feel like we haven't explained what the movie is.
Right. And I feel like there's been a lot of other instances where, you know, a studio just doesn't give a shit about a movie, but it's still a really good movie. You know, Trick or Treat, you know, like numerous others where they don't know what they had, and we've talked about that. But it's like, they really didn't know what to do with how to market this, you know, and their idea was just to try to market it at basically the equivalent of Star Trek conventions and Comic Cons back then. But Comic Cons back then weren't shit, right?
Like, it was basically Star Trek or nothing.
Yeah. So that's, and they did most of their marketing in comic books, which now maybe makes me think about it. I wonder if that's how, like, people, how it still pertain, or it still was able to be inside the public knowledge, you know, because it was in comic books. I'm wondering if those would get passed down and people would be like, what the hell's this? What's this ad for? You know, maybe that was part of it, or like tapping into that kind of nerdy, geeky culture, you know, and people clung onto it, you know, but on all accounts, I think this movie would have been buried. Somehow it just managed to, you know, still be in the public eye, you know, or the, you know, pop culture consciousness.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it really did get buried, getting put up against Indiana Jones and Ghostbusters and everything else. I mean, it kind of was set up to fail, but at the same time, like, what does your ad campaign look like? What was the rating on this? Was this PG-13 or?
I think it was PG-13.
Because it's not R.
No.
Well, no. PG-13 didn't come out until Temple of Doom. So probably would have been
PG or R, you know, right. Then.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no nudity. It probably would have been PG.
No, there's no bad language, really. I guess I would have tried to market it to kids or something, you know, just make, because I feel like this is a movie made by kids for kids kind of a thing.
Right. It really, I mean, at times, like, it does feel like, you know, an elementary school kid wrote it. I was trying real quick to look up the rating and I can't find it. I don't know what the rating is. It doesn't say. So maybe it was unrated. Who knows? But yeah, I do feel like it's just one of these random movies that's just like, I feel like it would be successful today if they were to make it now, but then it wouldn't really be like this type of movie. I don't think you could make this type of movie again, you know?
I think the name is really weird. Like, you would have to try to do some like viral snakes on a plane marketing where, like, but even that was a failure because people are like, oh my God, there's this stupid movie called Snakes on a Plane. Right. And no one went and saw it.
No one did. But it's, I don't know. It's so interesting to me. The more times that I see it, the more that it does grow on me. And I felt like the last two times that I watched this movie, like I was really smiling throughout the whole thing. Cause it's just so ludicrous and preposterous, but then equally like unintelligible, like what the hell's going on, but you're still kind of halfway following along. So there is some like entertainment value to it. But then there's all these like little details where you're like, oh, I missed that, you know, on the fourth time that I watched it. I saw it this time, you know.
Yeah.
So I do really enjoy it, I guess, in a way.
I didn't dislike it. I think, you know, the Big Trouble in Little China comparison makes a lot of sense, knowing that, you know, from the mind of the guy who wrote that movie, I just think that movie probably had a little more appropriate level of restraint applied to it. So it feels like a much more focused movie, even though they're both in the same vein.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be a good double feature.
It would be.
You'd start with Big Trouble in Little China, and if people are still around.
Then you put in this one.
Yeah. And you put that, and hopefully they're not too drunk by that point. Too rowdy.
What did you think of the humor in this movie? Did you find it funny? Because there's things that a lot of the articles that I read about this movie, they say like it's a comedy. And I don't really think of it as like very funny, like slapstick, but more amusing, where it's kind of like you get like the, that's funny, like snort, you know?
Perhaps. I wouldn't say it's a comedy. I felt like I was watching like a superhero movie.
Yeah.
Like someone's idea of a superhero movie.
Yeah. Someone's idea. They may have gotten it right. Who knows? It's up to you.
If anyone can remake it, it'd be Marvel.
Yeah. Oh, God. So I found a quote from a Redditor that goes by the name of Dr. Rotwang, and he basically said it the best. He said, it's the quintessential cult film. It's a chunk of what the fuck that still has legs. It's delightfully weird, and it plays to its own rules, and it's fun, you know? I think that's about the best way I could describe this movie. You know, it's not for everyone, I don't think. It's one of those weird movies where I can't really recommend it to people unless I know a lot about them. You know?
Yeah, no, that's true. And I don't think you could ask for a better escape hatch than that quote, because that's like, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, that's all that I got. Do you have anything that you want to add?
No.
Okay. Well, thanks again for listening, everyone. As always, if you can give us a follow on our social media pages, we are at Post Credits Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. And if you can give us a 5-star review on Google Podcasts and Apple Podcasts, whatever podcast platform you're listening to, we'd appreciate it.
All right. We'll see you in the next episode when we take on the World Crime League.
Right.
The teaser for the planned sequel.
Right. And just remember
this movie.
Just remember, no matter where you go, there you are.